cliffcentral.com.
Thomas Grant is a barrister from England, but he's also a very, very talented man. He's written plays, I saw. You've participated in mock trials. You've done all kinds of interesting things. And you're also an author of great renown. Many books are already part of the bibliography here, but I'm most interested to talk to Thomas Grant today about his new book, which is called The Mandela Brief, which is the extraordinary story of Sir Sidney Kentridge, whose name is probably, and I should hope, something that is familiar to most South Africans. He was the famous anti-apartheid lawyer who not only defended Nelson Mandela in the Rivonia trials, but also Desmond Tutu and Albert Luthuli, so all our Nobel Prize winners. A very, very interesting story, and we'll get into that in a second. But first of all, welcome to South Africa. It's lovely to have you here.
Gareth, thanks for having me.
Sure. You really do have a very, very impressive CV, and I'll get to that in a little while, because I've always been fascinated by how the legal profession in England works, with the Inns of Court and
sure.
You know, what taking silk means, and you know, why barristers are different to solicitors, and how it all works. And it's quite mired in a lot of tradition, which I think has actually created the impression for very many people, which is probably true, that people like you, and there are only few who can put QC behind their name, tend to be the smartest people in the legal profession. So
KC now,
KC,
Gareth.
That's right, quite right. Sorry,
we. I mean, it's an easy mistake to make. We've been QCs for about 70 odd years.
Isn't it a good thing that you aren't basing that on the Prime Minister, or you would have had to change it every
back and forth, back and forth. Yes. Can I just say, I was in the Constitutional Court yesterday as an observer.
Yes.
Seeing a absolutely fascinating case being argued in Johannesburg, and various of the advocates who I knew had invited me to come along and see it. And one of the, you're talking about traditions. One of the things that struck me was that the gowns that the SCs, the senior counsel, were wearing were exactly the same as the gowns that an English QC or KC wears. And the gowns that the junior barristers or advocates were wearing are exactly the same.
Oh, really?
They you wear a different gown if you're a senior counsel as opposed to a junior.
Have they abandoned wigs?
Sadly, they've abandoned wigs. And I think they abandoned them quite a long time ago. But the bands are still there.
Okay.
And though we wear wing collars, which were detachable wing collars we put on with little studs. And I noticed that the South African advocates were wearing just regular shirts with the collars down and the bands coming down. I'm not criticizing in any way, I should say.
I don't think it looks as good. I'll just say that. No, it is fascinating. And you've dealt with some really interesting cases. I hope we'll be able to touch on some of those through the course of this conversation. But first of all, why the story of Sidney Kentridge? I mean, I can tell that he's a really interesting man, and he's probably also quite well known to South Africans because of William Kentridge.
Absolutely. As he says, I'm now in the happy position that my son is more famous than me. I think he's absolutely delighted by that.
I think it's so rare in a family to have two absolutely iconic people in one generation from each other, and
yeah,
for both of them to have been so successful at such different things.
Yeah, and there's been it's an annus mirabilis for both of them. Sydney's turning 100 in November 22, so very close to where we are now. And William's had a Royal Academy in London one-man show, which I've been to, which is basically the whole of the Royal Academy taken over. Quite astonishing.
Well, Sidney Kentridge, of course, is a man who has a very interesting history, not only in law. I mean, he's a personality, non pare. You know, he's the kind of guy who could probably spin a really good story himself. But for him to have some of this told by you, and really your writing is it's not only funny and clever and witty, but it's also really thorough, and
you
know,
Gareth,
what you're talking about. So it couldn't be the kind of thing that a pedestrian could write, especially when it comes to law. And I'm sure lawyers are very nervous about people writing their stories unless they're competent in some of the more complicated stuff.
Well, you asked me a little while ago how I came about it, and I'm not necessarily the obvious person to write this book. And 4 years ago, I was not an expert in any way in South African history, and I know that South Africans are very, very punctilious about their history, and I've never known people who know more about their history than South Africans. Quite astonishing.
Really?
So I've spoken to a lot of South Africans, and their understanding of their past seems to be infinitely greater and more profound than my own country people.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Well, no, it's true, Gareth. And it meant that taking on the task, one had to be tread very carefully because you were treading onto, you know, important terrain. And I wasn't, as I say, the natural choice. I immediately say it, having been an English lawyer and having, you know, spent most of my life or all of my life in England. I just happened to have written a book a few years ago about another centenarian advocate, an English advocate called Jeremy Hutchinson. Right. And Sidney, who I knew from afar as a great man in England, wrote me a rather charming letter after the book came out and said he'd read it and had enjoyed it. And we met a couple of times and I obviously enjoyed meeting him, but there we left it. And then a couple of years after that, or 3 years after that, a mutual friend who'd read my book about Jeremy came up to me and said, look, Sidney's now 96. He's got a lot of memories. He's got a lot of great stories, which we need to preserve and capture. And I think, Tom, as he put it, you should write Sidney's book. And I said, well, look, that's a huge undertaking and not something I'm going to undertake lightly. And obviously we need to talk to Sidney first because one can't just start blundering in. So we met Sidney a couple of times and the mutual friend really knew Sidney quite well and was very, very friendly with him. And Sidney was pretty not immediately favourable to the idea. Oh, right. No, largely because he's a very modest man.
Right.
As he said to me and Edwin Glasgow, our mutual friend, who's interested in me? I'm an old man now. These are the things I did are way in the past. They're historic now. I'm just not sure anyone's going to be interested in me. And we had to really persuade him that he was being, frankly, too modest. And once we'd really established that this was not a biography, although I write about some of his personal life, it's not a biography. It's a book about the work, not the man as a private man. He was gradually persuaded. And also I think the fact that he'd read my earlier book made him realize that I wasn't some fly by night figure. I would spend proper time researching the book and properly conveying it, because it's very easy to be very superficial about these things. And I was, you know, conscious that I didn't want to, given the contested territory we're in, you know, it's obviously very important territory. One just couldn't be casual about it. And that was something that weighed heavy on me throughout the process of writing the book, which lasted about two and a half years. It had to be, it was a short time because it really had to come out in his 100th year, which is this year, 2022.
Well, when you mentioned things weighing heavily on you, I can't think of anything that must have weighed any more heavily than the responsibility of having to defend the Rivonia treason trialists. you know, these are people who are all in South Africa, hallowed figures.
Sure.
Now.
Yeah.
At the time, though, he took an enormous risk in representing them. And it was a very difficult thing to argue. The stakes were extremely high. And we might not have had our first democratically elected president had he not argued the way that he did, only in respect of the actual trial, but also in the sentencing, the mitigation of sentence, so, which would have been death.
So Mandela was prosecuted many times. I mean, it's staggering that he was able to do all the things that he did in the 50s and 60s, because most of the time he was seen to be being pursued by the state. Mm. And yet at the same time, he was running the first black owned and black run attorney's practice in South Africa. Mandela and Sisulu and Tambo, which a firm that flourished for many years, and they had a huge practice. And in fact, when I the book is called The Mandela Brief. There's a slight digression here, Gareth. The book is called The Mandela Brief, and the title is a slightly cheesy title, one might say, but it's a striking title at least. And the reason it was chosen in the first instance was because of Sidney's representation of Nelson Mandela. But quite late on in the writing of the book, I came across an English judge who'd been born in South Africa and had emigrated to England in the very early 1960s and had been an attorney as a very young man in Pretoria. And he said to me, do you know what, Tom? I remember receiving phone calls from Nelson Mandela, who was an attorney in Johannesburg, phoning me up and saying, look, I've got an appeal in Pretoria. I'd like you to be my agent, my solicitor's agent, my attorney's agent, to go along to the courtroom. And I've instructed as my advocate on behalf of the client, a certain Mr. Kentridge. So Alan Ward is his name. He's a famous English judge now in retirement. Remembered sitting behind Sydney in the late 50s in the Pretoria Court on the instructions of Nelson Mandela in Johannesburg. And that gave the meaning, the word or the phrase Mandela Brief, you know, another layer of meaning. So as a Nelson Mandela, not only as a lay client, but also as a professional client as well. And then 2 years later, Mandela and a lot of other of the great figures of the anti-apartheid movement, as you mentioned, are find themselves prosecuted in the treason trial, which is tried in Pretoria at the old synagogue, mm-hmm. A remarkable building which had been sequestrated by the state for security trials. Spends 3 years. I mean, he was in his mid-30s, and he took on a case, Sydney, with a bunch of other wonderful and great advocates, I should say. He took on a case where initially 156 defendants were accused, the largest prosecution ever brought in South Africa, I think, or since, all accused of treason, which, as you say, carried a capital sentence. And for 3 years, between 1958 and 1961, with a couple of gaps, Sydney and some of his co-counsel go up every day from Johannesburg to Pretoria, defending Nelson Mandela and the other co-accused. And gradually they whittle away. A lot of the co-accused get acquitted or get the prosecution gets dropped. By the end, there are still 30 or so accused who are in jeopardy of their life. And he secures the acquittal. In fact, the acquittal, this is the first trial, mm-hmm. of all of them. And that was an astonishing...
What a blow to the old government.
Yeah, it was an astonishing blow to the government. And especially when one thinks this was not a jury trial. This was a trial...
The stakes were absolutely against them.
And they had there were three judges specially appointed by the Minister of Justice, two of whom had close links with the National Party, all, of course, white, middle-aged, middle-class or middle-upper-class men, who one would have expected to be inclined to do the state's bidding and find these men and women guilty. But after 3 years of litigation, these three men, as the three judges, actually show just an interesting side to the apartheid regime, that the rule of law was not entirely killed off. This was a genuine courtroom. It wasn't like a Soviet people's court. It wasn't a show trial. And Sydney's very keen to emphasize this, that one, although the rule of law wasn't flourishing in South Africa at that time, nonetheless, it was worthwhile being an advocate. You weren't just conniving in a corrupt sham process. And of course, if you were a defense lawyer in Nazi Germany, you were a mere conniver in a sham process. It was not a sham process. And hence the fact that Nelson Mandela and his co-accused were acquitted, this is in the first trial in 1961, showed that. You mentioned the Rivonia trial. That takes place in 1963 to 1964. Sadly, from my narrative, Sydney is not involved in that case for this, I mean, relatively amusing reason. He had a client in the Rivonia case called Bob Heppel, who was an Englishman, and who was one of the accused. Bob Heppel is let out on bail before the trial starts, and Sydney's been lined up to represent Heppel at the trial. And of course, there were all the other great figures who were also lined up as accused.
Yeah, he was required to do that.
Yeah, and Heppel then fled the country. He fled the country to England, then became a very illustrious figure in England. So Sydney had no brief. His client had bunked off. So in fact, the Rivonia trial, Sydney wasn't at.
Yeah.
And Nelson Mandela and the co-accused were represented by a great figure who's, I think, very well known in this country still. And I think an airport may be now named after him, Bram Fischer.
Absolutely.
Who was a huge friend of Sydney's, and they were colleagues in chambers together. Sydney was led by him. He was his junior in a lot of cases. And eventually, as I write in the book, 2 years after that, 2 years after Fischer hadn't secured Mandela's acquittal, because that was essentially an impossibility, but as you say, had secured his life, because he wasn't famously was not sentenced to death when everyone thought that was a real risk. Fischer then achieves this great event, great feat, Then he himself is prosecuted, Fisher, as a under the Suppression of Communism Act. And it's fair to say Fisher was not only the leader of the South African bar at that time, Sydney at this time is a young man, he's not only the leader of the South African bar, he's also the de facto leader of the South African Communist Party. Quite extraordinary. This eminent commercial and criminal silk, who's, you know, the all the mining companies want to instruct Fisher, right. All the insurance and banking companies want to instruct Fisher in their grand commercial cases. At the same time, he is a communist, and at the same time, he's working to perpetrate and to expand the struggle. And he's then prosecuted. And who does he turn to defend him? Fisher, this is.
Yep.
He turned, and there's a very complicated story which I won't go into, but he turns to his junior colleague in his group, in his chambers, as we'd say in England, Sidney Kentridge. And Sidney has the melancholy task, we're now in 1965-66, has the melancholy task of defending his former leader against charges of a, not treason, but sabotage-related charges. An impossible task, actually, because the evidence was overwhelming. And Fisher, you know, was not in any way ashamed of what he'd done. Took the view that I've committed crimes, but they shouldn't be crimes. I've done the right thing. And Sidney has to spend 5 or 6 days defending him as best he can. And you talk, Gareth, about the death penalty. One of Sidney's most powerful memories, which he relayed to me, was after his friend and former leader and colleague, Bram Fisher, been convicted, and again, he was convicted for crimes that carried a potential death penalty. He then witnessed Sidney, the prosecutor, so another advocate, standing up and saying to the judge, "We, on the behalf of the state, suggest that the proper sentence in this case against Mr. Fisher, QC, as he was still a QC because he'd become a QC before the Republic, should be sentenced to death." And Sidney thought that was the most outrageous thing he ever heard, or one of the most outrageous things he ever heard in a courtroom, was to hear another advocate positively advocating the death sentence for, at that time, the most famous and most respected advocate in South Africa.
Well, history has probably been much less kind to that no-name advocate than it has been to Bram Fisher. But you, the way you so meticulously told this story now, and this is what I loved about the book, is that you've gone into a tremendous amount of detail and effort to make sure that you get it right. I'm sure that's because Sidney would have wanted it to be right before.
And I couldn't stand it being wrong. Because it would have been a humiliation, and B, just an unthinkable thing, because one has got important history in one's hands and one doesn't want to trifle with it.
What a story. This could be a movie.
Well, if anyone's out there.
Yeah, I mean, someone should be looking at this for a movie. It really, though, in the way you tell it, it's, despite the fact that you said you didn't really know much about South African history before you took on the project, I mean, you speak as if you've been lecturing in history for the last 20 years.
Well, it's kind of you to say so, Gareth. It's fair to say I read a lot of books. I read a lot of transcripts of trials. I interviewed a lot of great South Africans who I've become very friendly with and who've been really helpful to me. I really want to emphasize that there's a huge body of advocates and attorneys and judges of this country who I sent emails to out of the blue saying, look, I'm doing this project. I'd really love to talk to you on Zoom. I couldn't get out here because of the pandemic. I'd love to talk to you on Zoom and interview if you wouldn't mind. And to a man and a woman, they all said, I'd love to talk about Sidney. I can't think of anything I'd prefer to do. I'd like to do more. They were so keen and so generous with their time. So that was great. But just to go back, Gareth, if I may, to the, you talk about films.
Yeah.
Sidney has been portrayed himself in a film before. After the Biko inquest of 1977, which was, of course, an event that your listeners will need no reminding of, an English playwright, or in fact, a South African playwright, wrote a play of the inquest, which was, in fact, it was more a collation than a play, but nonetheless very artfully done, a two-hour summation of the inquest, which was drawn entirely from the transcript of the inquest. And it was a famous play in its day, and it was put on in the London theatres. There's a famous story, if I may digress from myself, where Sidney went to the opening night of the play at the Riverside Theatre in London, and he went with his friend Bernard Levin, who was a famous journalist, and went to see the play. And the place commences. And the magistrate, played by an actor, says, "Yes, Mr. Kentridge," in the way that it's your turn to now advocate. And Sidney claims it's completely apocryphal, that when the magistrate, as played by whoever the actor was, said, "Yes, Mr. Kentridge," Sidney, stood up as if he was back there in the courtroom.
Incredible.
That was Bernard Levin's story. Sidney claims it's not true, but it's still a great story. But it was then turned into a film, this play.
I didn't know this.
And the man who portrayed Kentridge, one of my absolutely favourite actors, Albert Finney, played Kentridge and one can still see it somewhere. Played Sidney very well.
There seem to be so many historical threads that are all interwoven in the story, and I think some people are fortunate to be born at a particular time and in a particular place to be able to participate in history the way that someone like Sidney Kentridge did.
Well, he certainly participated in it. I mean, he spent a good deal of his early life fighting in the war. He was in the South African Air Force for a long time, and as a result, only came to the bar at the relatively late age of 27, because 4 years of his early life were taken up, or 4 or 5 years taken up with the war.
But also to do these tremendously important and historic things, and to have been the advocate for these people at that time, and being in your 30s that's extraordinary. He obviously had there's a streak of genius there. I mean, there are people in the law, I'm sure you're one of them, I'm sure you know many of them, who are just extraordinarily clever people, and they are adept at this in a way that it can't all be attributed to experience and training. People take to it like a duck to water. I've seen it happen.
Gareth, I'm so pleased you have such a high and positive view of the legal profession.
Many people
I have to confess to you have a slightly more jaded opinion of the legal profession.
I do know some advocates who I would use the word moron to describe.
Okay,
But the ones I'm talking about, like Sidney Kentridge, they are the reason they're so stellar and they stand out so much is because there's something special about them.
Well, I've been a barrister in London for quite a few years, and while I was growing up in the law and as a junior, the name Kentridge was a huge name in England, because as I mentioned in the book and as probably known to a lot of your listeners, Kentridge left South Africa gradually. It wasn't one day I'm practicing in South Africa, the next day I'm practicing in London. He shifted his practice over a period of time during the late 70s and early 80s and into the mid 80s to London, and set up as a barrister in London, practicing in London. And he, by the time I came to the bar in the early to mid 1990s, he was the most famous barrister in London. And he was he had this aura about him. And that is extraordinary, because London is not a place where outsiders can necessarily break in to the legal profession easily. There are a lot of barristers in London who are all vying for the big briefs. Mm. And within 10 or so years of arriving properly and full time in London, Sidney was the leading advocate in London. And this year, he's now in his 60s. So there is something undoubtedly very special about him. I will say that. And the book has been described by some as tending towards the hagiographical. Mm. And Gareth, I have to confess, I plead guilty to that charge, but with, as I've said
That's
before,
not the worst thing to
with mitigating, with mitigating circumstances. Well, I didn't want to write, it's not a biography. Yeah, it's not an objective biography. Yeah. It is a celebration of a great figure. But more than that, I hope it's a celebration of the power of advocacy and how advocacy can actually change things for the better. And it's also, it's not just about Sidney Kentridge. It's about, I write about the trials at great length and I try and put them into their historical context. So it's not just Sidney's greatest hits.
You seem to be especially interested in making sure that we don't lose these great stories in the law.
Yes, that's true.
How did that happen for you? Because you've got an illustrious career in law yourself. How much time do you actually have to write these books? Because it seems to me that you're a fairly busy man, and you've written plays, and.
Yes. I mean, that's kind of, you say
prolific,
so.
You're prolific, you're busy.
Yeah, well, I am quite busy. It's fair to say I'm quite busy, and my wife has a few things to say about that, as do my long-suffering children. I like to say yes to things. I like to pack things in, and it helps Gareth not watching television, as I keep telling people. It's an annoying thing to say, but if I was asked what are your favorite box sets, I would have no answer to that. And I always see the interviews in the newspapers where the person said, what box set are you watching at the moment? And I would have no answer.
Would you at least be able to do Desert Island Discs?
Sydney was on Desert Island Discs. Sydney,
I listened to all of them.
It's a very charming, it's a lovely, I mean, it's very rare that a lawyer is on Desert Island Discs, because as you can imagine, lawyers are not necessarily thought of as the most interesting people to have on as interviewees. But Sydney was on Desert Island Discs. I think he was on his 90th birthday, and it's a lovely 45 minutes. It's available on the internet, and I should say he was 90, which was the same year that he finally retired from the bar.
That's one of
my favorite stories about Sydney is that he was on his 90th birthday. So this is November 2012, he was retained in Great Britain's, in the United Kingdom's Supreme Court, which is like the top court of the land, in some very, very complicated appeal relating to complicated legal matters. And it was like there were six parties, there were hundreds of lawyers came into the Supreme Court. And Sydney, on his 90th birthday, stood up and made his submissions to the Supreme Court. And I think unprecedentedly in the Supreme Court history, or perhaps the history of any courtroom in England, the judges all wished him a happy birthday.
Wow. And as you say, 100, you know, and lucid and together. And some people start falling apart in their 60s. And,
yes.
And he's still all there.
He's absolutely all there. He is. I mean, I've only got to know him. I mean, I only became friends with him, if I can say that. I hope I can say that. When he was 96, really. So our friendship is one of his later friendships, perhaps. And but you know, I spent an awful lot of time interviewing him about his memories and going through a lot of his cases and trying to capture those memories. It's fair to say a lot of those interviews were at quite an arm's length because we were in the middle of COVID.
COVID, of course.
One of my horrors was turning up to interview him, sitting relatively close to him and giving him COVID. I mean, that was there was a lot of complications involved because this was being written in 2020 and 2021. But he's had a very short retirement because he, as I say, only retired in 10 years ago. But he's really had a good retirement, and he still goes to Glyndebourne a lot. He traveled to South Africa until, I think, his last visit to South Africa was in 2019. So, you know, he was coming here until the age of 97. And then, I mean, he would have carried on coming, but then the dreaded pandemic intervened. And that, of course, put paid to any further visits. And he's celebrating, as I say, he's got a party lined up for his 100th birthday, which I'm very honored to have been invited to.
That's terrific. You've done some very interesting cases yourself, and I'm sure that you're also one of those people who doesn't like to talk about yourself. You'd prefer if I just stuck to the book, but I can't let that happen. It's not often that I get someone of your experience in the studio to talk about things that I'm also interested in. I mean, among other things, you represented Boris Berezovsky, didn't you? One of your clients.
I did.
A
I
long
did.
List of interesting
I did.
Clients.
I did represent Boris Berezovsky. He was. You may remember he had sued Abramovich for, I think, £3 billion of the largest claim in British history. And I wasn't involved at that stage. And he then lost the case.
Contingency there would have been nice.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he lost the case, but he had apparently promised all sorts of people cuts of the winnings. And then obviously there were no winnings because he'd sadly lost the case. And then people turned on him and people sued him, and I was brought in to represent Boris on some of these claims that were then brought against him when he had his back to the wall and a poor chap was being, I mean, his whole life was spent talking to lawyers. And then we had a great signal victory in 2000, I think it was early 2013. And then 3 months later, he died. And you know, we had all this litigation which we were doing, and then 3 months later he died, and of course his death remains
mysterious.
I mean, some people are very clear that he did not kill himself, he did not take his own life, and that he was murdered. I have no special insights into that, but it was a Yeah, I mean, I met him a few times. He was an utterly charming figure, albeit you just felt this guy is ground down by, I mean, who wants to spend their whole life talking to lawyers day in, day out? And sadly, he was having to do that.
The other person I'm very interested in hearing about is Lord Sumption.
Yes.
I've seen quite a lot on TV, and I don't watch much TV either, but when COVID hit, that was kind of one of the things we felt we had to do, so you knew what was going on, knew what the rules were because they kept changing them every day. And I saw Lord Sumption on TV making a very strident,
yeah,
and I thought extraordinarily well thought through argument against the lockdowns and the draconian measures that have been taken not only in England but all over the world. And I think I didn't know who he was before
that. Yeah.
Obviously he's not someone who would be familiar to South Africans, but I looked into his history and he's an extraordinary man.
I'll spend a little time on,
yes,
on Jonathan Sumption, because there is a Kentridge connection.
Oh?
Well, the big one, actually, which is that when Sydney arrived at the English Bar, he joined a chambers, which is a very famous and still remains a very famous and grand chambers called Brick Court Chambers. It was called One Brick Court then. And Sumption was in those chambers. And Sydney and Jonathan Sumption did a lot of cases against each other. In fact, at one point, they were the two kings of the English Bar, you might say, and they were very good friends, but also doing cases against each other. And when I had a launch of this book in London, I diffidently wrote to Jonathan Sumption saying, "Would you mind giving a talk, a little speech at the book launch?" Which Sydney, of course, attended, and we had a lot of people came to the book launch, as you might imagine, because Sydney knows a lot of people. He's a very well-known figure in England. And Jonathan Sumption very kindly said, "Yes, I'll do that," and came along and gave a absolutely superb speech about Sydney. And you know, Jonathan Sumption is a man who is not known for being effusive about the qualities of others, because I mean, he is often said to be the most intelligent man in England. Yeah. And I think with some reason he is. I mean, he became the leading advocate really after Sydney sort of gradually wound down. And he spoke with such warmth about Sydney. It was a very moving event. And just to say a few more words about Sumption, because he was at the bar. He was also a historian, and he's written a 5-volume account of the Hundred Years' War, which is one of the most learned undertakings. This is not pop history. This is history with thousands of footnotes. I mean, he's a medieval historian to begin with. He then became the leading advocate at the English Bar. He then became a Supreme Court judge without becoming a High Court judge. He leapfrogged straight from the bar to the top court in England
and
you know, developed a very substantial jurisprudence as a judge then, and then stepped down from being a Supreme Court judge. He then gave what is known as the Reith Lectures, which is a famous set of lectures that the BBC runs, and has become a public intellectual. So he's lived many different lives, Sumption, and he's now, as you say, in the last 2 years, he's become a public intellectual. He's also become a polemicist, and he's, as you say, he's appeared on a lot of TV shows.
Yeah.
He's appeared on a lot of radio shows. He has written a lot of articles in the English and possibly the foreign press. And he's got a very particular view on a lot of subjects. And he took a very firm view on lockdown. And whether you agree with it or not, it wasn't a ranting view in any way.
No.
It was a very carefully thought
Absolutely.
Out, incredibly analyzed view. And
yeah.
I think a lot of people say he may have had a rather important point.
Absolutely. That little window that I got into this man who you've just told us even more about, and now I'm more fascinated still. Just seeing how he argued these things was a masterclass in how to convince people that they're wrong and that you're right.
just like Sydney, Sumption doesn't only speak or advocate in sentences, he speaks in paragraphs. If you listen to him being interviewed, as then there are lots of interviews on the internet with Sumption, he never fumbles for words. He speaks as if he was reading a book or writing a book. He has an incredible capacity for clear thought. And I think that's why, one of the reasons why Sydney and Jonathan were and remain such good friends. They themselves did a podcast, would you believe it?
Amazing.
Sydney's first and only podcast. He did about 8 months ago. And they came together in conversation, and I think it's available on YouTube to talk about
the
old
days. Homework. You're giving me so much homework here. Can I ask you about this overlap between art, performing art in the form of plays and law? Because actually, when you think about it, what goes on in a courtroom is very often a bit of a performance. It obviously has to be grounded in facts and good argument and sensible and meticulous information and detail. But there is a lot of it that is about performance.
A very beautiful voice helps. Yeah. And Sydney has a beautiful voice, as though he's got a lovely South African accent, but quite a soft South African accent. The ability to know when to change register is vital. One of the things that Jonathan Sumption said about Sydney was one of the great aspects of his advocacy is whenever he started a sentence, the court never knew how it would end. You know, with an advocate, you can predict exactly what they're going to say because there's a sort of formulaic quality to it. I mean, in terms of the performative qualities of the Kentridgerian advocacy style, and he was well known as one of the great, if not the greatest advocate of the century. And that's certainly my proposition. Of course, there are others who would vie for that. But you know, he was calm and precise, but then would dispute this as being actoral or theatrical. But there's then the modulated flash of anger or the modulated flash of irony, and if you get it right, then it can be devastatingly effective in court. But you've got to modulate. You can't just be permanently angry. If you are permanently angry and cross, as some advocates are, then you lose your court completely. If you are precise and careful and then allow yourself moments of anger, irony, or wit, then you are much more effective. And Sydney was the master of that. And that, I mean, it's performative. Whether it's theatrical or not, I couldn't say, but it certainly is performative.
And
if there is a distinction to be drawn there between the two.
And you sound as if you're a master at this too.
I would. Gareth, what do I say to that?
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen.
But
you
I do like. But I value the art of advocacy. I mean, I don't classify myself as some master of it, but I do think it's important.
There is art to it.
Yeah,
that's absolutely indisputable.
A lot of commercial and chancery barristers, and which is what I broadly speaking am in England, are suspicious of advocacy as a concept. I think it's fair to say, and that they think too much performativeness is a bit fly or whatever. I think it's fair to say I fall into the more performative, the more flamboyant side of things.
I don't know if this is true about
Go
you,
on.
But I, this is something I read and I thought was absolutely fantastic. Apparently you appeared in a Queen Boudicca mock trial.
I did.
And you said that you posed a question. You were obviously appearing on her behalf.
I was leading counsel for the defense. I should make it very, very clear.
She'd been charged with terrorism.
She was charged with terrorism.
Who famously attacked the Romans and tried to free the Britons.
Absolutely.
She was the famous queen and rode bare-breasted. And there's a statue of her just outside of Westminster.
I think that's right, yeah.
You appeared then to defend her and you used the line, "What have the Romans ever done for us?"
Yes,
and you did say the aqueduct.
there is the aqueduct, as the Monty Python line goes. Of course, I plead guilty to. I allowed it was a charity. There's a wonderful charity in England called Classics for All, which wants to expand the learning of the classics. And one of the things they do is hold mock trials in the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom, which is in London, just opposite Parliament. And they have trials of Alexander the Great or Socrates. And every year they do it. And this year, the last year, I was asked to lead for the defense of Boudicca. And it's a sort of 1 hour thing. And it's meant to be both funny as well as educative.
Did you prepare for that like you would for a real trial?
Well, I was given that the judge was a Supreme Court judge. I and a lot of the audience were members of the judiciary and very senior silks. Well, I wanted to get it. I wanted to get it right. It was being filmed. It's on YouTube. I really did not want to fluff it. So I actually prepared for it very, very carefully. I had a very good junior, I should say. And you know, I'm pleased to say that my arguments prevailed, and there was an overwhelming verdict of acquittal from the audience. Gareth.
Are they going to make you a judge at some point, do you think? And would you like that job?
One doesn't get made a judge in England anymore. One applies to be a judge.
Oh, do you?
There's the tap on the shoulder.
I thought that happened like taking silk.
No. And taking, in the old days, the one became a judge through the notional or the metaphorical tap on the shoulder. That has been cleared away for very good reasons, because it just perpetuated the old boy network, so to speak. It's now a level playing field. You apply to become a judge, and it's a very long application form. It's a very open and transparent process. I should say, I have no ambitions to become a judge, not for some considerable period of time, at least.
And I'm sure
I'm an advocate I see myself as an advocate at the present moment. And also, I'm just sort of, becoming a judge can be quite constraining in terms of one's extracurricular activities.
Oh, yeah. And of course, then you don't get to choose what sort of things you do. Sometimes you have cases brought before you that are completely uninteresting to you.
You are, as a judge, especially if you're as a first instance judge, as a judge of the first level, you are doing whatever you're told to do. So there's a certain amount of going back to the starting point.
What law do you love? When if you get a brief, and there must be some that you love far more than others, but which are the ones that you go, can't wait to get my teeth into this, or this is something sexy or exciting about certain stuff and other stuff not? And it varies from barrister to barrister, but what's your favorite stuff to do?
Well, the doing work, I mean, having work at all, I do not want in any way to be presumptuous that, you know, as they say, the barrister is always terrified that he or she has done their last case.
And that's of course, they have a pocket in the back.
You never know. You know, there's that. There, as a self-employed person, you're always worried. You're always worried about, you know, am I? You're only as good as your last case. Why am I? You know, there are many other people in the sea looking for the same briefs, and why is it going to come to me?
So we have too many lawyers.
I think it would be. I think there are many, many lawyers. I mean, now and certainly, my daughter was telling me that every single person in her year seems to want to become a lawyer. It's seen as a thing to jump into. You asked me what are my favorite briefs. I don't do crime. I've got to say it immediately. I do what I describe as chancery commercial work, which is work involving business disputes, company disputes, property disputes. So they're not the most obviously narratively fascinating cases, but from my point of view, they always throw up interesting intellectual challenges and factual challenges. So you can find, this is a very dull answer, but one can find interest in really many different types of case. And to the outside world, the case might be absolutely dull as ditch water, but every case creates a forensic challenge, which is, how am I going to win it? What advice am I going to give to the client? How are we going to get the client out of the particular predicament that they may be in? So there is interest in all cases. I should say that I'm very fond of fraud cases, and I've written a long and very turgid book on the subject, or co-written a long and turgid book on the subject. And fraud is quite a big area, and it generates quite a lot of courtroom action. And in fact, one of the most well-known cases I was involved with, although many other lawyers were as well, was a case against a Kazakh oligarch called Mukhtar Ablyazov, who was alleged to have been involved in, I think, the largest fraud in world legal history. He was alleged to have defrauded several billion dollars from a particular Kazakh bank.
Unbelievable.
I mean, I say it was an allegation only. It's an allegation only. I acted for him, so I'm certainly not going to throw stones against him.
Kazakhstan, this is a bit James Bondy.
Well, the great thing about being an English lawyer, or one of the great things, is that everyone loves to litigate in England, because it seemed to be a country, and rightly so, where you will get absolutely perfect justice, whoever you might be. I mean, not cheap justice, I should say. You know, the English lawyers are relatively expensive, I will immediately say that. But people choose to litigate in England because they think they're going to get a very high quality of return in terms of the service they get both from the lawyers and, so to speak, from the judges. So, you know, Kazakh banks suing Kazakh, former chairman of the Kazakh bank, you find them suing in England. Berezovsky is litigating in England. Abramovich is litigating in England. I mean, it's fair to say that the Russian work has slightly dried up because of the sanctions regime.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Russians love to litigate in England, and English lawyers were more than happy to help out.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think there are many questions about that, I should say, which probably we can't go into. There are ethical questions surrounding those points, I suspect.
I'm so pleased that you managed to take some time to come and talk to us today. And I can't say enough about the importance of Sidney Kentridge and his contribution to our history. But thank you for helping us to tell our story in such an excellent way, and for including South Africa and particularly our legal history, which I think is an area which very few people explore anymore. And putting it really front and center. It's terrific to have you here, and well done on the book. Amazing.
Gareth, thank you so much for having me. CliffCentral.com.